I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and I am in London today. It has been another day of drama over Brexit. Prime Minister Theresa May held a news conference this evening. She is standing firm, saying she is going to do her job, make tough decisions, and push her Brexit deal through Parliament.
My approach throughout has been to put the national interest first. Not a partisan interest, and certainly not my own political interest. I do not judge harshly those of my colleagues who seek to do the same, but who reach a different conclusion.
Now, Robin, some of those colleagues have resigned today, including May's Brexit secretary. There's also a member of her own Conservative Party calling for a leadership change. So a lot going on here, and we will follow it during the show.
Okay, but first to California, where the Woolsey Fire is still burning in the south. In the north, Butte County officials say there are now more than 300 people missing from the Camp Fire. And there are questions about whether equipment from the utility company PG&E may have ignited that fire, and questions about whether the company is being held accountable for its role in other fires. Last week, the company told state regulators that one of its transmission lines had an outage around the time when and the location where the Camp Fire is thought to have started. And this week, Camp Fire survivors sued PG&E, saying it failed to maintain its equipment. Well, PG&E's stock dropped more than 20% yesterday when the company said its insurance wouldn't cover billions of dollars in liability if it is found responsible. Dale Kassler has been covering all of this for the Sacramento Bee. Dale, bring us up to speed. It's common for tree limbs to hit power lines and cause sparks that cause fires. This has been an ongoing concern.
It absolutely has, Robin. Last fall, when the horrific fires hit the wine country and killed more than 40 people, PG&E's equipment has been found responsible for a majority of those fires, and the company is facing in excess of $10 billion in liability from those fires. The company has started a preemptive program to trim tree limbs more aggressively and to actually do preemptive power outages when the winds kick up. In fact, they had one of those about a month ago. Yeah. They thought about doing one last week and canceled it because they thought the winds had subsided. So PG&E is really up to its neck in wildfire issues, and it looks like here we go again.
So the company is making the case that it's doing the best it can, that, in fact, one of the biggest problems here is climate change and the increasing heat, the winds that whip up these embers. But your colleagues at the San Jose Mercury News write to say, remember, PG&E is a convicted felon for its negligence in the 2010 San Bruno gas line explosion that killed 8 people. And I guess there are questions about what else the company can do. Can it put these lines underground? I mean, what else can it do? What's the thinking? Is it up against an insurmountable problem? Or is there more that it could be doing?
I mean, they have, you know, thousands and thousands of miles of power lines. And I know it's been suggested about planting the lines underground. That's a long-term solution, certainly, that the company has discussed. But that's not going to happen tomorrow. You know, for the immediate future, you're talking about power lines strung together overhead by power poles.
So what do you think will happen here? They are saying they won't be able to pay, but people who've lost homes are suing.
Well, exactly. And nobody's quite sure where this is going to go. A couple of months ago, Governor Brown signed into law some legislation which gives PG&E and other utilities a partial protection against liability if it's found that the company was not negligent. The Public Utilities Commission could allow the utility to pass on at least some of the costs to ratepayers as opposed to the shareholders. So it's at least partial protection, but it doesn't kick in until January of 2019. So that doesn't do the company much good for the fire that's burning right now. It's also worth remembering that PG&E has gone bankrupt before. PG&E went bankrupt in 2001 during the energy crisis when its reserves were kind of bled dry by Enron and the other wholesalers, and the light stayed on.
Well, was that because taxpayers, you know, bailed the company out? I mean, are you looking at Californians both suing this company for what they see as negligence and then potentially having to help bail the company out?
Well, there was no bailout in 2001. The creditors, the energy sellers, took kind of a haircut I don't think the legislature is going to be in any mood to fork over money for PG&E. But it is possible, at least with future wildfires, that ratepayers could be facing higher monthly utility rates. Everybody seems to acknowledge that, I hate the phrase, but yeah, this is the new normal. With climate change and other factors, the summers get drier and hotter, and the fires get worse and worse.
Well, and you mentioned the law that Governor Brown signed recently, and some people are calling that a utility bailout. And one of your legislators there, Senator Jerry Hill, says that maybe PG&E has to be split up. Is there any thinking of that?
I don't think it's, I mean, it was definitely a controversial bill, and it was labeled a bailout by critics. I'm not sure anybody has demonstrated what good it would do to split up PG&E. I mean, I guess presumably two smaller companies could do a more efficient job of maintaining the power lines and the transformers and all that. But I don't know that that's proven fact either.
Doesn't sound like there's a good solution here.
No, there's no easy solution because the fire season's getting longer and longer. I mean, it's November out here. It's actually cold. This isn't happening in August.
Yeah. And a reminder that people are in tents and things and they're cold.
Exactly.
And they'll need their utility.
Mm-hmm.
Dale Kassler of the Sacramento Bee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, even as people come to terms with the devastation in California, the tourism industry throughout the region is expecting to take a big hit, and it's starting to feel like a new normal. Yearly fires and the smoke that fills much of the region. From Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon, Liam Moriarty reports.
For decades, the Green Show has been a staple of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland. The free outdoor show, six nights a week all summer, has a changing cast of musicians, dancers, and other performers. La Victoria, a Latina trio from Los Angeles, made their Green Show debut here in 2016. This summer, La Victoria played the Green Show's final performance in late August, 7 weeks before the season was supposed to end. The reason? Persistent unhealthy levels of smoke from regional wildfires.
Our losses this year that are smoke-related will be over $2 million.
That's the Shakespeare Festival's artistic director, Bill Rausch. He says there were 26 performances of main stage plays at the festival's 1,200-seat outdoor theater that were canceled or relocated to a much smaller indoor venue because of smoke. Then there's the impact on the wider community.
The most profound hit financially is people who just choose not to come because of smoke.
Rausch says those people don't see plays, they don't go to bars and restaurants, they don't go fishing or biking or river rafting. Travel Oregon, the state's tourism agency, calculated that during last year's smoky summer, Oregon businesses, employees, and governments lost nearly $70 million. This year's losses haven't been counted up yet, but they could well be more. Recent wildfire-related impacts in California and Washington as well have brought West Coast tourism agencies together to tackle the threat. Ryan Becker with Visit California says many out-of-state tourists this summer had the impression from the news that the entire coast was on fire and canceled vacation plans in places that were completely unaffected. He says one major initiative of the new West Coast Tourism Recovery Coalition is a website to make sure travelers have accurate information.
You can get all the information you need about where the impacts of the fires, where the impacts of the smoke, travel planning resources from all of us. So you have it all at your fingertips.
But letting prospective visitors know that things aren't really as bad as they think will go only so far. Brad Niva with Travel Southern Oregon, the regional tourism board, acknowledges that smoke is likely becoming a regular part of summer here. Niva says if the tourist economy is going to survive, business people are going to have to get creative.
When we have these iconic businesses such as the Oregon Shakespeare Festival or Hellgate Jet Boat Excursions or the Brit Festival that could lose their business because a visitor will not come, we need to start thinking about it reinventing our tourism economy.
First step, he says, is to get some data.
We've actually started to do some research, like who else has had to change their tourism economy, and we don't really have a lot of examples.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown recently announced a $51,000 grant to Travel Southern Oregon. It'll pay for market research on consumer perceptions about the region and how wildfire and smoke may have changed their willingness to visit. Business leaders are already pondering ways to adapt, but Brad Niva says there aren't a whole lot of options available to the many outdoor recreation operators that have made the region a summertime destination.
Hiking, mountain biking, rafting, jet boating, any of those things that are key to June, July, and August, because we have higher water levels, we have great weather, usually very family-oriented because kids are out of school. That is a very difficult product to reinvent.
Some hope a more aggressive program of thinning and prescribed burning in the surrounding forests will reduce the size and frequency of wildfires. But whether that will happen or whether it would even work is far from certain. Meanwhile, communities that rely on the tourist trade are watching the climate on which they built their economies change, and it's not yet clear what they can do to change with it. For Here and Now, I'm Liam Moriarty in Ashland, Oregon.
This is Here and Now. Here in London, where I'm broadcasting from today, almost everyone knows who Jon Snow is. Not Kit Harington, who plays Jon Snow on Game of Thrones. I'm talking about the news anchor Jon Snow of Britain's Channel 4.
Hello, good evening. The fragile agreement within...
He joined ITN in 1976 and became Washington correspondent in 1984. Since then, he has traveled the world to cover the news. And he sat down with me at the ITN studios. Well, Jon Snow, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
How do you think that Britain got here? Why was there a vote a couple of years ago? Why was it so close? And why is everybody so determined to actually carry through with it?
It's very simple. The Conservative Party has been split on Europe ever since we entered the European Union, and even long before that. And David Cameron reached the point, and he was Prime Minister at the time, where he felt, well, there's only one way to resolve this, and this is to have a referendum. So it was a referendum to heal a hopeless division in the Conservative Party. Currently, as we speak, the Conservative Party now is more riven and more divided than it's ever been in probably its entire history. The referendum was staged in the sense that it was called and there was a binary question whether to leave or remain in Europe. But, of course, it was an absolutely massively complicated question to which there was not an easy binary answer. Leave or stay really doesn't mean anything. And there were lots of people who, particularly old people, who really did want the Britain of yesteryear. You know, when Churchill was around and, you know, there was a sort of sense of deference and the Union flag meant something. And, you know, they have a sun-kissed view of the past.
Some of them still think that they're going to get that.
They do, but some of them are dead, of course. You know, some of the people who voted are dead. A lot of young people didn't vote at all, really thought the whole thing was, you know, not something that they needed to bother about. And that's another factor in what might happen in the future.
You think there will be a second referendum?
I'm dubious. I think the political classes have been so badly scarred and stung by the first one. I mean, we live in a representative democracy. Germany, who tried referenda in the 30s and it delivered them Hitler, ban, you know, nationwide referenda to this day in their constitution. And we should do the same. That is not a sensible way of deciding extremely complex questions and can leave you with some very serious trouble.
A lot of people have made the comparison between the Brexit vote and the vote in the United States for Donald Trump, which a lot of people in the U.S. didn't expect to happen. What do you think of that comparison? You just got back from the United States where you were covering the midterm elections.
For Trump, read Brexit. They are very, very similar entities. I think many people accept that the Brexit vote, particularly for those who voted to leave, goes back to the banking crisis of 2008. And the response by this government, and I think possibly in America too, was to deal with it, not by jailing bankers. No, it was in fact to cut public services.
So you're saying inequality is at the heart of this?
Inequality is at the heart of this. I see both sides of the Atlantic. And I don't think we can live in this way any longer. We have to accept. It is stunning to a European that this gorgeous country, America, has, you know, all these resources, all these riches, but has no welfare system. And by that I don't mean there's not absolutely no welfare. Of course, you know, there are chinks of welfare. There's even Obamacare. But you don't have what we have, which is cradle-to-grave care. Although, albeit it's been badly eroded, we have cradle-to-grave
welfare, and an absolutely free health service.
But what do you think about the fact that the response to that issue of inequality is a move in both of these countries to the right, not to the left?
Well, that's what's so strange. I think both votes represent people who say, look, frankly, they've tried everything else. We don't like the way things are. And frankly, we'll just try this. And after all, some very loud voices have told us this is going to be terribly good for us. So let's try it out. We tried the rest and we're no richer. So let's go.
I first got to know you on television when I was a student studying in London back in 2003, and you were covering the build-up to the Iraq War. When you look back on all the things that you've covered, and the rise of Nelson Mandela, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Iraq War, this, how does Brexit stack up in terms of its importance in British history?
Well, this was described by a minister in the present government who resigned the other day over Brexit, who described it as the greatest catastrophe facing Britain since the Second World War. And I think that this, he's not wrong.
How do you think journalism has changed since the 1970s?
Well, I think it's much easier. I'm not a doomsayer. I mean, of course, the social network has introduced abuse and all sorts of fake news and this, that and the other. But generally speaking, for those of us who practice journalism, it's infinitely easier. We have access to untold quantities of information that we could never have got before. Government cannot tie up in red ribbons things which they don't want you to read. They get out and they get published online and the rest of it. And I think that the digital age has facilitated what we do in a way none of our forebears could ever have imagined.
For the better or the worse?
I think for the better. I think both the New York Times and the Washington Post are better than they've ever been. I actually think NPR is better than it's ever been. Yeah. And you know, these people who go around saying, oh, you know, it's all gone to the dogs, there are no good journalists left anymore, it's all fake news. I'm sorry, it's not actually true. Of course, there's a lot of noise out there. But if you want to know the facts, you can get them in a way you've never been able to get them before.
You know, we get emails all the time to people who listen to our show, and I've experienced this throughout my time in journalism in the U.S., and they say, why aren't you as tough as the people in Britain? How come you're not asking questions like them? There is a more combative approach, I feel like, to journalism over here. You think that's true?
I think it's true, but I do think it's the job of journalism to ask combative questions that is actually to question power. I think one of the big problems is not journalism, but it's power. I think the consequence of the last 25 years of the growth of the financial services industries right across the world has been to sap up some of the greatest leadership in the world, some of the most able people, some of the most creative people. I have interns who've worked for me who said, I desperately want to be a journalist. And I said, great, I'll help you every way. And they said, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to pay off our student loans. So I'm going to go and work for an insurance company in the city. But I'll be back and I'll be calling you. And
right.
I said, thanks.
Yeah, right.
Five,
see you soon.
Six, 7 years on. Hello, Gladys, are you still there? Oh, well, I've paid off the loan, but we're getting a flat. And then we're going to buy a house. And, John, maybe one day, but no, it'll be no day. I think this is one of the great truths of our time. Look across the world at the leadership. Germany's collapsed. France is in trouble. I mean, in terms of leadership, Italy, this is Europe and the rest of it, okay. But America, I mean, too. I mean, I want to be kind to Mr. Trump, but nobody could say it's exactly quite what the founding fathers had in mind. Where are the leaders of the past?
What is your favorite story that you've ever covered?
The one that I learned most about and enjoyed doing in learning was covering the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Mm. I found myself in a country of amazing people, highly educated, badly led, a country rich in resources, and 6,500 years of civilization, more than evident. And I've been there practically every year ever since. Hmm. A lot of those things are still true, but of course, because of the terrible breakdown in international relations with Iran, some of which are their own fault, the country is in terrible crisis and may well fare worse and worse as time goes on.
What is it like to be the other Jon Snow now that Game of Thrones has become such a thing?
Well, I know nothing, and I am a bit of a bastard. But actually, I'm delighted. After all, they spell his name the same way as me, J-O-N-S-N-O-W. I interviewed him about the program, mm-hmm. and at the end of it, I said, Jon Snow, you know nothing. And he replied, bastard. I don't know if NPR allows bastard, but there it is.
We'll find out. What about the ties? You're sitting in front of me. You're wearing an incredible green tie.
Yeah.
You've got socks to match, blue and green socks. I remember when I used to watch you that every night you'd have a different, usually stripy tie on, right? Colors, different colors. Where did that come from?
Well, you can see our studio up there, and it's full of purples and blacks and whites. And it's a very bright and funny, good studio, really good studio. And I was the dullest thing in it, because you have to wear a suit. There's no other way around it.
Right.
I mean, I thought I could play with the suits, have a red suit, a green suit, a yellow suit, but I thought that might take away from the seriosity of what we were talking about. But then I thought, the one thing you could do is wear better ties. And there are lots of people making craft ties if you only find them. And I'd also thought, as we don't have a desk, that the socks was a good idea too. And frankly, it's never let me down, you know. And I have various tie makers who come in and show me what they're doing. I have to pay for them, but...
How many ties do you have now?
Probably, I mean, the trouble is, when I get really bored with them, they go to charity, and that raises a lot of money. But I suppose about 150.
Wow.
I got thanks to Texas, I bought a very good revolving tie rack in Texas. So I call it
Bigger in Texas.
I call it my Texas tie rack.
Jon Snow, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a delight to talk to you too.
You can see a picture of the tie and socks Jon Snow was wearing when we met him at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Today, a judge was expected to rule on CNN's lawsuit against the Trump administration, but he delayed it and may rule tomorrow. So will he rule that White House staffers were within their right to revoke the press pass of CNN reporter Jim Acosta because they thought his behavior was unprofessional? Or will he rule that barring one reporter abridges the First Amendment rights of all, as CNN claims? Let's take a quick look with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And David, we know the judge in this case is a Trump appointee, but he didn't tip his hand during the hearing. So how did he question the parties?
Well, he seemed to go a little tougher on CNN's attorneys than on those from the Justice Department representing the White House on this. And yet, you know, it's not clear where he's going to land. Among the questions he had for CNN was whether they could really draw a direct line between upset with Acosta's, persistent, perhaps rude questioning and tossing him out, withdrawing that pass. He pointed out that Trump had blasted a lot of people, including CNN fake news, for quite some time. And hadn't revoked that pass. And of the Justice Department, he questioned, whether the White House felt that it had the right to revoke the credentials of pretty much any reporter for pretty much any reason. And the White House, the Justice Department said basically yes.
Yeah. Well, and the White House originally said they'd ban Acosta because he laid hands on an intern, the woman trying to take the mic. They then released a doctored tape from a conspiracy theorist. But they're not using that in their defense. Is that a problem for them?
I think it is. I mean, certainly CNN's lawyers are trying to take advantage of that, saying that, they have shifting rationales for the revocation, and that undermines the credibility of the Justice Department's case for the White House. The White House, acknowledged that it was not relying on that. In fact, lawyers conceded that point under questioning from the judge. So that has been withdrawn as evidence of the inappropriate behavior that it still is attaching to Acosta, but it's now attaching it on the basis of his persistence and unwillingness really to yield a microphone.
So are you surprised that Fox News joined other media organizations in siding with CNN?
You know, let's say that from a journalistic standpoint, you could argue that the right thing to do is also a very canny thing for Fox News to do. That is, a number of news organizations have joined in filing briefs supporting CNN, both as a sign of journalistic solidarity and an acknowledgement that maybe in another administration, another president could well pull their reporters' press cards. Let's think of, you know, if you imagine a very liberal, if President Elizabeth Warren on the Democratic side really disliked Fox coverage or Fox opinionators about her, she could pull it in, mm-hmm. in rebuke. And if they said, if the court said that's totally fine to do, then Fox could be in that position. It's also a way of Fox reminding people of its journalistic element at a time when a lot of its opinion hosts, which really drive the bus over at Fox, are under a significant critique for the kinds of conspiracy theories that they sometimes spread.
So in closing, we've got about a minute. Are you worried that in CNN, literally going toe-to-toe with the administration, it might color their reportage? And on the other hand, even if the president loses, he's cast CNN as the adversary, and they were.
Well, this is terrain that Trump in some ways is happy to fight on. That is, making it a head-to-head battle between him and the press, and he uses CNN often to encapsulate that. At the same time, legal scholars I've talked to and some media executives say sometimes you can't shy away from the fight, even if it's one that's desired. I think this is one case where the real question is, what if CNN loses?
Yeah.
And then suddenly they don't have that right to the press pass in the way that they thought they did.
Yeah. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik will hear from the judge hopefully tomorrow in his ruling. David, thank you.
You bet.
I'm in London today, where Prime Minister Theresa May is standing firm behind her Brexit deal, despite what has been happening around her today. Senior ministers resigned, including May's Brexit secretary, and a member of her own Conservative Party is calling for new leadership. Prime Minister May acknowledged that during a news conference at Downing Street tonight.
They must do what they believe to be right, just as I do. I'm sorry that they've chosen to leave the government, and I thank them for their service. But I believe with every fibre of my being that the course I have set out is the right one for our country and all our people.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson joins us now with the latest. Rob, there has been so much activity over the last few days. Where are we right now?
I'm tempted to ask, Jeremy, what on earth have you done to our country
right,
since you arrived? Everything's going to pieces since you arrived here. You know, I was reading a book the other day about the French Revolution, and although there are no guillotines being erected here outside Parliament, there's definitely a sort of whiff of revolution and chaos. I guess the short answer to your question is that we are in a moment here of profound political crisis in the UK over what Britain's future relationship with the European Union should be, and more immediately how it should leave. And what we're seeing at the moment is the Prime Minister not just fighting for the deal that she thought that she had won to achieve that separation and begin a new relationship, but fighting for her very political survival. I mean, these are truly almost revolutionary times here.
We can hear the protesters behind you.
Yes.
You're there at Westminster right now. We're hearing about a possible no-confidence vote against Theresa May. What are the scenarios involving her future?
Well, there's no doubt that a very significant minority of the Conservative Party, who are very, very pro-Brexit, thinks that she's messed up the whole Brexit process, that Britain's departure from the European Union would not be as abrupt or hard as they would like it, not enough of a clean break as they would see it. And they're so angry. The question is, will there be enough of them to mount a leadership challenge? I mean, here's the thing for people who don't want to get too mixed up in the weeds mm-hmm. of British politics. It seems to me that the crisis is, whether they get rid of Theresa May or not, whether it's her or anybody else leading the Conservative Party, that party, the governing party, is deeply divided. And it's very difficult to see not just that party, but the opposition, Labour Party, is divided. How on earth any deal gets through Parliament? Do you see what I mean? It's difficult to see what kind of arrangement would win a majority in Parliament.
Is there a possibility of a second referendum? This is something that's been talked about a lot over the last few days, that they could put the question of Brexit again to the people for another vote.
Do you know, I think it's just growing all the time for the simple reason that what would spark a second vote, a second referendum? It would be the sort of sense that the politicians are completely gridlocked here at Westminster. And again, I keep going back to saying why this is a profound political crisis. It's profound because, one, this is a very important issue. It's Britain's place in the world, its relationship with the European Union. And two, because the leaders of the two main parties, the leading figures in the main political parties, particularly in the governing party, they are not agreed on what Britain's future relationship should be. And given that deadlock, given that it's hard to see a deal getting through Parliament, maybe that will be it. Maybe that'll be the only alternative, grisly though it might be for many.
Well, and I was just going to say that almost everybody would admit that a no deal would be the worst possible outcome. But in fact, that's not the case. There are some members of Parliament, Brexiteers, who would like to see no deal at all and just have Britain crash out of the EU.
That is true. But I've noticed that some of them have got a little bit more wary about that over the last couple of days, because all the scenarios looked at by businesses, most economists, most neutral observers, is that it would be absolutely catastrophic for Britain to leave without a deal. And in a way, that remains Theresa May's best card, I think, for getting her version through Parliament, that idea that leaving the European Union without a deal at all, or having a second referendum or a general election, a domestic political crisis, just about anything is better than any of those.
Just a few seconds here, Rob, but I have been watching you on TV here in the UK, on BBC One, on BBC World. I've been listening to you on the radio here. What has this been like for you?
Goodness, I never thought about it that way. I suppose, you know, that sort of sense of watching history, you know, right, thinking that these are just not normal times. I mean, Britain was, up until very recently, I suppose, in some ways, it still is a stable, prosperous, right, democracy. What on earth has happened for its politics and its people to become so poisonously divided?
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been out talking to people here in the UK about Brexit. Here in London, we met Pat Metcalf from Liverpool. Did you vote in the referendum?
Oh, definitely.
And you voted?
Oh, to stay.
You voted to stay?
Definitely, yes.
Why?
Well, because we just didn't want to... we were all quite happy how we were, and nobody knew what was going to happen. We didn't, and we still don't know what's going to happen, do we? And we didn't approve it at all, and we thought that there should have been a bigger percentage of the people who voted, because we thought that the vote was too close. We thought it was really quite unfair.
What do you think is going to happen now?
Well, we're just really quite terrified, really, because we'd no idea, and everybody's telling lies as far as we can see. And we don't like to think about it, because we were hoping to go abroad later in the year. We will have been married 50 years next year, and we don't book because we don't know whether we need visas, and it's quite a worry. I think we're all very worried about it.
Here now is Peter O'Dowd, talked with Paul Benham in Derry in Northern Ireland.
Brexit will not help at all. We're so used to feeling part of the North and the South, feeling almost as if they're the one thing, that the border doesn't exist. If they bring a border in here again, well, that was always the problem in the first place. The border was always the problem, mm-hmm. You know. And that's what people are worried about, that somehow or other they're going to split the country back up again.
Did you vote to remain or to stay?
Oh, I would always remain. Staunchly European, you know. I feel more European than I would even feel Irish. You know, I'm happy in France, I'm happy in Germany, I'm happy in Italy.
I went up to Coventry in England and met Glenn Davis. Did you vote in the Brexit referendum?
I did, yes, 2.5 years ago, and I'm still waiting.
So you voted to leave?
Yeah.
So do you think that's going to happen?
I'm not so sure now. If you'd asked me that question 2.5 years ago, I would have said we'll be out within a week. But 2.5 years later, we're still in. I don't think so.
What do you think happened?
I don't think they expected people to vote out, so they didn't. I think they would have fiddled the referendum votes if they'd known we're going to be out.
What about you? Did you think that people would vote to leave?
I thought we'd vote to stay in. I was surprised when we voted out.
Do you think there will be a second referendum?
I think Theresa May would love there to be a second referendum, but it's 50-50. I personally think there will be.
Would you feel betrayed if there were a second referendum?
Yes. I wouldn't vote. I've already voted once. I mean, when I voted last time, it didn't say this is the best of three. It said, do you wish to leave the EU? Do you wish to remain? I voted out. No, when the ballot paper did say this is the best of three. No, I wouldn't vote again.
Finally, Jackie Clues in Coventry. Did you vote in the referendum?
I did.
And how did you vote?
Out.
Vote to leave?
Yes.
Do you feel good about that vote today?
Not particularly. I don't think we had enough information before the vote.
What information have you gotten since that you wish you had had before?
We've had the negative side of what it could possibly be, but I don't think there was enough focus put on that before the vote. And I think the way the country's gone, I think we wanted to be independent and self-sufficient. I think most people are tired of being dictated to by Europe.
Are you?
In some things, yes. I think we ought to make some of our own decisions.
Do you think there'll be a second referendum?
No, I don't.
Would you feel like it was good or bad if that happened, though?
I think the people have voted, and I think we should stand by that vote. But I'm not saying that I would vote the same way if there was another vote.
Some voices around the UK about Brexit. You can find all of our coverage at hereandnow.org.
We've talked about influencers, ordinary people who share opinions about products on social media and often are paid by the companies who make those products because they know it's much cheaper than traditional advertising. Well, now there are patient influencers, people who share their thoughts about medications, sometimes paid by the drug makers and represented by companies that broker their services. Kate Sheridan is with our partners at STAT. And Kate, you wrote about one such company, WeGo Health. How does this work?
So it works in several ways. One of the focuses of my piece was that this is now happening in an organized way through what I referred to as almost like a talent agency for patient influencers. This particular company will talk to pharmaceutical companies, to drug developers, and ask them what they'd like help with. And then they will go through their database of influencers that they've collected over the years they've been in business and see who would like to work with this company.
You profile a patient, Anne-Marie Ciccarella, not a doctor, not a researcher, someone getting paid by drug companies to promote a product. What are the kinds of things that they say?
Well, in Anne-Marie's case, what she does is actually two, I think, different things. She has written about procedures that she's had done that have been free of cost to her, but she's also been paid for her time and her expertise as a patient directly from pharmaceutical companies. So she's spoken on panels about what she's learned as a patient and as a caregiver. She's spoken about what could be done differently in some cases.
Well, so she maybe can be critical of the drug industry, but doesn't this raise the same questions that it does when we learn that doctors, for instance, are being paid by the drug company or being given things like trips to promote certain medications that you can't trust? I mean, how can we trust that they're not just doing this for the money that Anne-Marie and other patients might be paid to talk about a product?
I think it does raise a lot of the same questions. But at the same time, the answer to that question is grounded in the same principle, right? Trust. We have to have some trust in our physician that they're doing what's best for us. And if we don't have that trust, then yes, of course, we should be questioning what they're advising. The same really holds true for these influencers. They have very dedicated followings based on the idea that they're a reliable source of information.
Well, for instance, if they are, let's say, a cancer survivor and they're still having treatments and they are not giving the correct information out to other cancer survivors, I imagine they would quickly not be an influencer.
That would be a huge problem, yes, not only for the trust that they've built with their following, but also with the FDA, of course. A lot of these patient influencers that this talent agency will work with, they very specifically want to provide correct information to patients, not just to anybody.
Well, and there is some light regulation of this, correct? I mean, you can't just willy-nilly post things.
If the company is putting out incorrect information, that's really when the FDA will step in and say, hey, you guys need to take this down and correct it. In general, the influencers are kind of responsible for keeping themselves in their own lanes. Of course, when you get compensated by a company for that, as we saw in the Kim Kardashian case, you do kind of reflect back on that company.
Remind people what happened with Kim Kardashian West in 2015.
So Kim Kardashian West posted something on her Instagram promoting a pill for morning sickness. She said that she had been using it during her pregnancies and it made her feel better. Unfortunately, she forgot or neglected, rather, to disclose the potential risks and also that it hadn't been studied in women with a particularly severe form of morning sickness. Mm. So the FDA sent a letter to the company warning them that it had to be provided next time and that the post should be taken down or corrected in some way.
And you've said that these could be niche patients. They don't have to have hundreds of thousands of followers. It just matters that people want to listen to them. But how many of these influencers do you think are out there?
I mean, this particular agency says it has a roster of over 100,000.
Oh,
I think,
wow.
Yeah, it's quite a lot. But at a certain point, those are just the influencers that have been identified.
And you've talked to a company, Synovian. How did they characterize to you the benefit of these influencers for them?
Not only did the company get more impressions, which is kind of a traditional marketing metric for products, but they also saw that more and more people were following through on certain actions that they have linked and have studied with actually getting a drug.
So I'm looking at the numbers here. Their impressions, the people just looking at this, jumped from less than 100,000 to more than 13 million after they used the WeGo kind of patient hub service, talent agency, if you will. 13 million. Also, they saw that about 14,000 filled out a discussion guide, which to them, that's one step closer to buying the drug.
Precisely.
Yeah. As somebody who uses these influencers, how do you approach this? I mean, how much, you say it's a matter of trust. Is there a way to vet them? How do you trust it?
I think at a certain point, it's important that anybody who sees something on social media or online talks about it with their healthcare provider. A lot of people do that, and some people don't feel comfortable. They think they're going to feel judged, or they think that their provider is going to dismiss them. But it's really the only way, short of going through papers and trying to decipher the research yourself, to get a real sense of whether or not you should take action on something that you're seeing online.
That's Kate Sheridan from our partners at STAT. We'll link you to her writing about medical social media influencers at hearnow.org. Kate, thank you.
Thank you.
And a quick note, last night the 2018 National Book Awards were given out. Congratulations, Sigrid Nunez, who won the fiction prize for the exquisite The Friend. We'll post our talk at hearnow.org. Maybe we can influence you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at the BBC in London. It's Here and Now.